Well, I'll tell you right off the bat that for those of you who are listening really carefully and who were here last year, the last paragraph is the same. The sermon's not, but the last paragraph is the same. Surprisingly, I did not come to a completely different conclusion about the meaning of life and work. But as I sat contemplating what to say about Labor Day and the depressed state of labor and the depressed state of unions and the shift from the high percentage of workers who belonged to unions to the relative weakness of the union movement and the change of the union movement from really the private sector and the factories to the public sector, which is a sea change in how we understand unions, I kept thinking about how did we get here? What's our attitude towards labor and towards work? And living in America, I had to think immediately of the famous Protestant work ethic. And it occurred to me as I contemplated the Protestant work ethic that it was somewhat like Voltaire's observation about the Holy Roman Empire, that it was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. Our Protestant work ethic is more of a trick than a reality. It was a way, very much like the religion imposed on slaves, to make workers just glad that they had a job, to make workers believe that they had contracted for a fair day's wages, for a fair day's work, and that they ought to shut up and just be grateful. But of course, the catch was a fair day's pay and a fair day's work were defined by the bosses. And so that fair day could be 18 hours for an 8, 9, 10, or 11-year-old. Those fair wages could be next to nothing, accruing debt to the company store. The difference between slavery as the ill, as at the time legal, ownership of a person and the economic ownership of a person is to some extent, not completely, but to some extent, a distinction without very much difference on the ground. If you have no hope of changing your jobs, of getting out of debt, of having decent working conditions that are not likely to either kill you quickly or kill you slowly, these are distinctions without differences. It's economic. It's an economic and social rather than legal form of slavery. Now, those were the bad old days, and today everything has changed. But not if you listen to Ron and Rand Paul, not if you listen to the people who have the deepest faith in the free market system and how the free market will really work ultimately to give you a fair wage. The free market will make the mines safe because people who can have choices in jobs won't go into unsafe mines. People who have choices will not go onto unsafe oil platforms. Our American workers would not go out into our agricultural fields and have poison sprayed on them because the market of labor would determine that everything will be just, in the words of Danny Kaye, written by his wife Sylvia Fine, just tickety-boo out there if the magic of the free market is allowed to work. Well, gee, it should work like that, but it doesn't. It doesn't. And the truth is we have very little respect for labor, which means we have very little respect for laborers. We have little respect for the people who plant our seeds, who harvest our crops, who smelt our metal, who make our cars and our planes. We have very little respect for the people who get their hands dirty. We have somewhat more respect, vestigially, for the people who take showers before work than for the people who take showers after work. Hard physical labor is not anything that we inherently respect in this society, and we marginally respect the people who take showers first and have white collars or pink collars or green collars as long as they're not blue collars or khaki collars. The truth is that workers of all kinds don't get much respect, and that there's part of a feedback loop in this, because workers often don't respect themselves because they are cut apart from what it is that they do. We have moved from a world where people make things, where there are craftsmen and artisans, towards a world where our identity comes not from what we make, but from what we buy. And it's understandable, given the change in technology. When there were craft cottage industries and people made things, they could feel a connection. There was a sense of satisfaction. But as the technology changed and people came to cities and came to factories and put bolt A on nut B for 8 hours or 10 hours or 12 hours a day, as people congregated in the mines and on the fields, there was a separation. A separation from the fruits of our labor. Now, I just used a Marxist phrase, and I think that Marx had some remarkable insights, but he was wrong on something fundamental. He talked about surplus profit, about the money that the capitalists stole from the workers. That's true enough. But the money can't build a bridge to meaning. If how one spends one's days is not filled with a sense of meaning and satisfaction, there's no way to pay the person to go through that hell for 8 or 10 or 12 or 14 hours a day. Unions came into being in order to try to bridge the economic gap and the safety gap. Unions came into existence over the metaphorical dead bodies of bosses and over the all-too-real dead bodies of all-too-many workers. And the unions did their job at that time and ameliorated conditions and made things better. But they're losing out now, and there is this new view, this new old view of the magic of the market, and the idea that that applies to people in service industries also, so that it's not just the person putting nut A on bolt B who is leading a repetitive life that is very likely to be without the gratification of an artist or craftsperson, but it's also the person in the service industry. I remember years ago the Billy Crystal movie City Slickers, where it's career day. And he goes to his kid's class, and there's a fireman, and there's a policeman, and there's a paramedic, and they ask him what he does, and he just gets up with this look of existential dread and says, "I sell air." He was somebody that sold advertising on radio programs without substance, something that's invisible. And too many people are not looking towards how we spend our days and are trying to compensate for with it by how we spend our money. So I am not the car that I make. I am the car that I drive. I'm not the cabinet that I make. I'm the antique that I own. This doesn't work. This doesn't work. It leads for both blue collar, well, for all, for blue collar, for white collar, for pink collar, into a frantic attempt to try to define ourselves by consumption. And consumption is one of those words that has a couple of meanings. It's what we consume, it's what we consume, and it's what consumes us. In the 19th century, it was a disease, often understood as tuberculosis, but often also undiagnosed cancer. We need, when we look at the world and the world of labor, to understand a couple of things. One, it's not simply the easy, oh, it's those darn capitalists who are exploiting everything, because in the workers' paradises across the latter half of the 20th century, the worst thing you could do was to try to organize labor in the Soviet Union or in communist China. You were going to be penalized at least as much as 19th century union organizers in the United States. It's about how the technology separates us from what we do and separates us from each other with these signs of status as opposed to real status. Now, look, those of you who know me, and after 400 years here, many of you know me, I like nice things. This is not a hair shirt sermon. This is not a give up everything, paint your walls gray, and go and flagellate yourself. I like nice things, but they're not important. What's important is what we do with each other. What's important is the love we make. What's important are our efforts to see the condition of others on this planet and try to ameliorate it. What's important is that we understand that meaning, however transitory and ephemeral, will not come from a thing. It will come from an act. And it will not be reflected in what we own and put up on a mantelpiece. It will be reflected in the eyes and in the embraces of people about whom we care. Meaning in life, in our world, it's going to be very difficult for it to be within the creative acts of our world, of how we make our money. But we mustn't identify ourselves either with the short term of what we do and believe that we can spend our lives working in misery and compensate for it by consuming in luxury and in debt, but in trying to find a balance of putting some sense of attention and joy into our work and understanding that that's where our hearts and our souls are. In the Bible, in Ecclesiastes reminds people that life is short, the sunset will come, and you can't take all of your gold, all of your wisdom, all of the pleasures that you have had into the grave, and recommends that we eat, drink, and be merry, that we eat our bread with joy with someone whom we love, that we spend our time trying to infuse what we have to do with a sense of meaning, with a sense of, and this is an interesting word in Latin and English, enthusiasm, entheos. It means the holy act of being within the divine in the moment that we are in a creative act. And bringing to our work lives and to our non-work lives a sense of attention and attentiveness and, when possible, joy. And not to be confused by status symbols that we own and the status that we earn with our relationships to each other. On this Labor Day, we can understand the old Latin ars gratia artis, that art for art's sake, and we need to do work for work's sake to find the virtue, to find the enthusiasm in what we do. And if anybody remembers the last paragraph of last year's sermon, it will be Will, because Aristotle said that virtue is in the creative act. In his case, he was talking about sculpture. He was talking about whether you are sculpting in wood or in stone, in brass or in gold. The virtue is in the work, not in the material. The virtue in our lives is created by the work that we do, shaping our lives and our time with the tools of our intentional and chosen values.